it requires certain safeguards to make sure that a use that wouldn't normally be allowed in the area can be allowed because of certain extenuating circumstances. There are good reasons for allowing this use in the area despite what the law might say. And those protections, as I outlined for you before, were that the applicant had to demonstrate that there were reasons why the goals that would normally apply to protect our farmlands don't apply in this case, that they have to go through an alternative sites analysis, and that they have to show that the consequences for the environmental, energy, social, and economic consequences will not be too significant. And finally, they have to demonstrate compatibility with surrounding uses. What we have here is in dash 8, we have standards that address at least two of those concerns, the environmental, social, and economic consequences as governed in subsection C, approximately line 9 and 10, refers to goal 5, and the goal 5 process includes that kind of analysis. Lines 6 through 9 address compatibility, and we're satisfied with that. The problem that we're having has to do with what's known as the alternative sites analysis. What this requires in the exceptions process and the rules promulgated by LCDC is that, in particular with a use that is not normally allowed in a rural area, that the applicant demonstrates why this use cannot be adequately accommodated in an urban area, inside an urban growth boundary. And this is not just an academic exercise for, you know, trying to decide what's urban and what's rural. One of the primary purposes for Oregon's land use planning program is that we keep industrial and urban-type uses in urban areas. We don't want to have our urban areas sprawling out over the hillsides of the state. So we want to make sure that if we're going to allow a use that is normally an urban-type use in a rural area, that there'd be some demonstration that there's a good reason for it. 1,000 Friends is consistently taking this position, and we concede that there are times when certain uses that are urban in nature can be justified in rural areas. And I think the process that we have through the exceptions program adequately deals with that problem. The suggested language that I was going to suggest for this amendment that would deal with this problem would be inserted at the end of line 11.
Now, is this in dash 8?
Yes, this is in dash 8.
With
the hand-engrossed version of dash 8.
Okay.
After the word processing that's handwritten, we would insert, and if there are demonstrated reasons why the processing cannot occur on lands already zoned for industrial use.
Read it again, Keith.
And if there are demonstrated reasons why the processing cannot occur on lands already zoned for industrial use.
Let me ask you, now I take it from the point of view of the oil people, you're not really involved in this discussion particularly, are you?
Not at all.
Okay. What's
Chair,
the, yes, Representative.
Did they want to be involved? No.
No, what they're saying is they're interested in the bill and the other members.
Right. No, just a little humor.
Just cut in
your little humor.
Well, you
break the ice.
You're entitled to have a little humor. The rest of us never do any of that. Give us your comment on it.
Okay. You might also want to ask Dick Engstrom to come up.
Yes, he obviously he's been there. He didn't wait to be asked. He came up, but that's all right. Come on up, take it.
Yeah.
We're asking Sue Hanna from the legislative staff to come in, too, because go ahead. Why don't you go ahead, and then Dick can talk.
Yeah, I think that the issue of the character of the amendment that Keith has described takes us back into that situation where you really are going through a kind of an exceptions process.
Right.
We really put it in the context of the conditional use permit process, but it is essentially that alternative sites issue that exists there. And that is the one thing that we have not addressed in this amendment. It's the one thing that OCAPA has had. One of really the reason that they initiated the amendment initially was to avoid that alternative sites test because they've experienced some litigation on that point. I think the other thing that you that from our perspective we need to take into consideration is this really a urban industrial type use? There seems to be some evidence that is convincing to us that as a class this may actually be a rural industrial type of use, given its need to be or is typically found at the mineral and aggregate extraction site. But I'll let Dick explain his.
But am I understanding this correct, that there really is the choice between essentially leaving it as an exception, or permitting it to be a use in the EFU zone with stipulations or limitations as was suggested yesterday, or as was suggested in Amendment 8.
Right.
Those are the choices. Okay, go ahead, Dick.
Mr. Chairman, I think that Greg has done a real good job. What we were trying to do is hopefully rely on the Goal 5 process and the subsequent conditional use process to allow us to bring processing and mining along normally to one site. With the 1,000 friends verbal amendment of a minute ago, that we have really accomplished nothing. We think that when it's implemented in the field, in essence, we will be right back to where we are today, so that all the compromising and the other things that we've tried to resolve are meaningless in terms of us trying to get to this one process. I'd like to emphasize this, that and this is not critical of Keith, because I've been very impressed in working with Keith, so don't read it that way. It's an honest difference of opinion. That I really, from my experience, don't believe that processing of aggregate resource are an urban use. It's been our experience that people don't want us basically where there's a lot of people around. Our success in putting them in industrial parks is probably a zero batting average out there. And so, you know, we're really, it's a dilemma is what we brought to the committee. Nobody wants us any place if we're processing. And I think somehow we got to get this land use process working, and we thought maybe this might be an approach to do it.
Let me ask, what about the wine people at this point? You were agreeable to, am I still correct that you were agreeable to the amendment that we thought we had yesterday?
Chairman Cease, my name is Arthur Weber of Weber Vineyards in Dundee, Oregon.
Yes.
The answer to your question is yes, we are.
So the real issue is this issue about urban versus rural. Urban versus rural.
May I finish?
Yes, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, I hesitated. I only have...
Do you hesitate? This is long.
I only have one question about the definition of a term.
Why don't you go ahead and ask that then?
Okay. That question is the definition of the term asphalt concrete, which is new to me. And I'd like to have a definition, or I'd like to have an answer to my question. Is that a generic term to cover all types of asphalt processes?
Give us an indication where that appears.
What's the term?
On Amendment 8 in line 6?
Yes.
Which says, of aggregate into asphalt or Portland cement. Is that what you're referring to?
No.
Into asphalt.
Page 2, line 2.
This is line 2 on page 2.
Okay.
The line begins with and aggregate into, and the term is asphalt concrete.
That's a good question.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Dick.
After a lot of discussion with our members to really zero in on the best term that was available to us that covered all this batching of asphalt as we do on these facilities, the membership came to the agreement that the proper term is either asphalt concrete or asphaltic concrete. I think the reason that it shows up asphalt instead of asphaltic is that with the definition of processing, we are now using the word asphalt instead of asphaltic. So I think that they said asphalt concrete. But it is not, it's a generic term that applies to all that stuff that we do as a part of our facility, our plants to make asphalt paving.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative,
what's the difference between asphalt
concrete and concrete. Like you put on the road, you know, you pour concrete for...
As I've gone through this...
Well, I'm sorry, maybe I'm coming in late.
The correct terminology when you're looking at this, it would be Oregon, Portland, cement, concrete. That is a correct term for the white stuff that comes in the ready-mix trucks. And the black stuff
is asphalt concrete. Okay, so the black stuff refers to what I used to call macadam, or whatever.
You used to call what?
Yeah, macadam.
That's a road.
Before you were born, Representative Jones, we called it macadam.
I thought she was only a couple years younger than you were.
Mr. Chairman, I noticed one of the key agreements that's been reached here is that no application shall be approved to allow batching and blending of mineral and aggregate into asphalt or concrete within 2 miles of a planted vineyard. So that appears to be one of the primary provisions in here for the resolution of the vineyard scars. But my question is, I noticed that we're deleting a couple of words here, exploration.
I want to tell the members of the committee, you've been anxious to move on, so let's not get this all twisted out of total out of shape. Go ahead.
I don't believe I have my answer, sir, to the question, which is asphalt concrete a generic term to cover all forms of asphalt batching?
To my best knowledge, the answer is yes. It's everything that we do on a site. It covers everything that we do on an asphalt batching facility as it relates to aggregate mining.
Okay. Anybody else want to add to that? Sue, you don't know anything about concrete, do you? You're a land user, not a concrete. All right. That's what I thought.
Chairman Cease?
Yes, go ahead.
If I might speak just a little bit on my verbal amendment and some of the reasons behind it. As many of you know, in 1986, the Supreme Court issued a decision in 1000 Friends of Oregon versus LCDC Curry County. It had to do with trying to define what are urban and rural uses in rural areas for better planning, better management, trying to keep our urban uses in urban areas. The court there identified certain uses that were clearly urban and certain uses that were clearly rural. For instance, in the housing arena, they identified one house per every 10 acre as being a clearly rural use. Whereas when you got into one or two houses per acre, you were getting into urban levels of density. Everyone seemed to be able to agree on that. The problem, of course, came with the gray area in between 1 and 10 acres. And that's where the court directed the agency, LCDC, to fill in the gap and come up with some rulemaking that would help counties and citizens of the state try to decide this issue. So far, LCDC has not been able to draft a rule, and it doesn't appear that they will be able to do so for quite a long time, at least a year. What we're dealing with here is a use that is in the gray area. In some circumstances, 1,000 Friends would concede that a batch plant could be sited in a rural area. We would still argue that it's an urban use, but there are reasons to allow the siting of that type of plant in a rural area. In other cases, it's not the case, that it's still an urban use and it shouldn't be sited in a rural area, and I'll give you an anecdote to illustrate. I mentioned last Monday a case that we've been tangentially involved with in Jackson County, where we've got a batch plant, or a proposed batch plant, that's going in less than 2 miles from the Ashland UGB. The target market that the applicant has chosen for the output of this plant is inside the Ashland UGB. Many of the raw material components that are not found on site will have to be trucked in from either Medford or maybe even from Ashland, from inside the UGB. And much of the labor that will be used to run the plant will likely come from inside the UGB. So what we have are raw material components, labor going outside of the UGB to produce an industrial use or manufacture a product that will be used inside a UGB.
Could I interrupt just a second? Now, inside the UGB, is that a say an industrial unit?
in industrial zone? Is it an outright permitted use in the city?
That would depend on the city zoning, but my understanding is that it would be.
Tremendously noisy. I've got to believe that the cities must have more protection than that, and it would require some kind of a conditional use normally. And I can't feature if there's any population density at all that that allow that kind of a plan inside.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Parkinson, just from my own experience, I know that in dealing with this case that there are three batch plants with inside the Medford UGB. At least two of those are sited within 2,000 feet of residences. I'm not aware of any...
Mr. Chairman, have they been sited recently?
I think...
This decade?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm through.
Let me interrupt you for a moment, because I think you're going down a track that I'm not tracking with. You're talking about court decisions. We're not the court. We're a legislature. The court interprets what we do. We don't interpret what the courts do. Now, if we decide as a legislature, we make the law. And if we decide as a legislature that a batching operation is proper in a rural zone and so write a law, that then is the law, is it not?
Mr. Chair and Representative Agrons, you're absolutely correct.
Right.
And
So what is the point of discussing legal issues and what courts have done when we're trying to reach a decision as to what is right and wrong regardless of what courts have decided?
Well, Representative Agrons, you're absolutely correct that the legislature is in charge of establishing overall policy, and it's the court's job to interpret that policy and not vice versa. What we're dealing with here is a court's interpretation of state land use planning goals, which were adopted by LCDC at the direction of the legislature to address specifically urbanization issues.
I understand, but nevertheless, if we decide an issue on what we consider to be its merits, regardless of what has gone on before, that then becomes a law, does it not?
Representative, you're absolutely correct.
Yeah, okay. I just want to be sure that we understand that, because we may very well do that.
Well, to further explain my answer, it's the court's decision was based on good policy.
In your view?
In my view.
Exactly. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kiesling.
Couple questions to make sure I have a crystal clear understanding of our crystal clear land use planning system. If we were to make this a conditional use and not include Mr. Bartholomew's language about the alternative siting test, could a county, as part of making this a conditional use, make as one of those conditions an alternative siting analysis? Could Jackson County, in the example that you cited, say, okay, if this passes, we are going to make one of the conditions that there be an analysis done of alternate sites?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiesling, that's correct. They could.
Okay.
All the uses allowed under 215, 213, and 215, 283 describe ceilings past which counties cannot go, but then it doesn't describe a floor for which they have to reach a minimum.
So let me ask the second question, which is why then put this into the state statute and not leave it up to the county?
Well, Representative Kiesling, I'm sure it's no surprise to you, and this is not news for you, that 1,000 Friends of Oregon have spent a lot of time trying to enforce the state land use laws, and our experience has been with with certain notable exceptions, counties cannot be depended on doing anything more than they absolutely have to. And I would say this is particularly true in areas of industrial or commercial type uses that have the prospect of revenues for the county.
Let me ask you though, Keith, and I don't know that I disagree with that in some cases at least, wouldn't it, even from your vantage point, be better to remove it as an exception and put it in as a permitted use with protections? Isn't that what we're doing? If you adopt 8 as we probably agreed to yesterday, it would be permitted on EFU zones under certain conditions. but, which means that the county could no longer make an exception if it didn't presumably meet those conditions.
Well, Chairman Cease, the way the law stands now, as I said before, is you have to go through a rezoning, and through most of those zones that allow batch plants allow for the imposition of conditions for the uses inside those zones. So, no, it wouldn't change very much on the ground.
Okay. Let me ask Representative Eggman, you had another question. Why don't you ask that, and then I'm going to ask Sue Hanna, who's legislative counsel, to come up, and we'll go over these. Going to work session, we'll go over these amendments.
I'm afraid I'm going back in time on this and perhaps talking to a different choir, but I suddenly became aware of 2086-6, which deals with geothermal. I happen to have in my constituency geothermal resources both in the city and out in the rural as well. I think I need to understand this. I'm sorry, I'm probably coming in late in the game, but I need to understand it and its implications, and I might even be in a place where I need to consult with folks, because I'm sorry, it's my fault, but I'm behind on this, and could be a trap.
Margaret, why don't you come on up? I would remind everybody that this becomes too overladen. Yeah. Too many pieces, it'll die of its own weight. Go ahead, Margaret.
For the record, my name is Margaret Kirkpatrick, and I'm here representing ARCO Oil and Gas. What we presented on Monday as the joint 1,000 Friends ARCO Oil and Gas amendments would have changed existing law by allowing not only exploration for all minerals in an EFU zone, but also allowing production of oil, gas, and geothermal. That was the ARCO Thousand Friends Amendment. When Liz Frankel testified on behalf of the Sierra Club, she objected to making production of geothermal a permitted use in an EFU zone. So we said we didn't, since I was not representing a geothermal interest, that it was not objectionable to either Thousand Friends or ARCO if geothermal was removed from the production part of the statute and just put back to the exploration. I would say that the way 2086-6 stands now with respect to geothermal is no change in the existing law.
But is there any change in dash 6 with regard to the existing law for exploration and production of oil?
Yes.
There was. And but it does not include geothermal.
Right.
So geothermal stands pat.
As oil
and gas or whatever, petroleum, it gets a broader interpretation.
Right.
Greater potential. Is that correct?
That's right.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I'm afraid I do have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. Representing a geothermal area where, in fact, most of our geothermal energy is very shallow and is used for space heating in homes, and our hospital and our college campus are also heated, but they're all shallow wells. Down in the Henley area, south of the city, there is also a geothermal area. And it's been a few years ago that there was some shallow drilling and some geothermal energy was used, again, for space heating in a greenhouse operation for a while. Which lasted a while, I think is no longer flourishing. But at the same time, there has been some deep drilling, some attempts to drill deep, because there is an anomaly in a place or two in which there is a potential, it is believed, if you'll get down a few thousand feet, maybe even more, for some substantial geothermal energy. I think that well went 1,500 feet or something, and they weren't getting temperature gradients, and they broke the bit, you know, and they said, oh, the heck with it, after spending a lot of money. But I wouldn't want to be to inhibit the potential for some one day to have that kind of an exploration done. And if, in fact, there's some real geothermal heat down there, and it is in fact very good clean energy and can be used for that purpose, they'll be able to go ahead on it.
Representative Agron, we don't have feelings about that one way or the other. The way 2086-8 reads now leaves existing law with respect to geothermal intact.
Okay. Representative Agron, Keith Bartholomew again, 1,000 Friends. I talked to Liz Frankel this morning and asked whether she could attend today's hearing, and she said she was having car trouble and probably would not be able to make it. So I can give you what her viewpoint is on this, or as I understand it.
I wish you would.
The current law allows for exploration of geothermal resources outright. In other words, you can explore for geothermal resources without getting a conditional use permit. So there's nothing that bars allowing counties to allow prospective development, or exploration, rather. Current law also allows development and processing of geothermal resources as a conditional use. The amendments today, as Margaret Kirkpatrick just outlined for you, would not change that. So there's no disallowance of any development of geothermal resources. The concern that I believe Ms. Frankel had to do not necessarily with the resources that you spoke of, the shallow wells that are being used for home heating and greenhouses and so forth. It had more to do with the situation that's going over in La Pine, and I know very little about it, except to know that what they're planning there, or what has been planned for some time, is to put in a major generating station, which could have significant impacts, eat up a certain amount of land of several acres in size, and is really qualitatively different from the type of oil and gas production that we're talking about in this bill.
Well, I thank you for explaining those concerns. Appreciate it. I would think, however, that if a person is going to make the kind of major investment, gamble, not even an investment, gamble, to go down 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 feet with a well, I think that's kind of what they're saying they got to do if they're going to find out anything there. Mr. Kirkpatrick, you could probably tell me how much it costs to drill a hole like that. Millions?
All I know is that at a typical drill rig, they spend about $15,000 a day.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But in any case, we're talking about a major investment. Now, unless there was a reason, a good reason to know that if, in fact, they found that, you know, major source of geothermal energy, that would, in fact, create a steam plant. Then they would have a chilling effect on their capability to try to produce that kind of energy.
Some more humor today.
Representative, let me tell you what we're going to do.
All right.
We're not going to get this, obviously, done. I thought we were, but we're not. So what I'm going to do is ask Sue Hanna to come up, and we'll go over these proposed amendments so she can make clear exactly what they do. See what we can agree on, then leave it. Either the parties can agree further or not, but we'll bring it back to a second work session at that time, vote it out one way or the other. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I want to make one comment, and I'm going to I'm doing this knowing I'm shooting myself in the foot, but I have to rely a lot on this committee to say, yes, you have a problem, or no, you don't, aggregate industry. But if it looks, in your opinion, Mr. Chairman, that the way that our amendments are going to kill this bill, then don't let it kill the bill. And I hate to say that because I don't have any problems with fighting this thing on through, but we made a commitment early in putting our amendments in here that if it came down to the point that you expressed a couple minutes ago that maybe by its own weight it might kill itself, then I suppose I've just shot myself in the foot. But at least I want to be square with the committee and everybody that I've worked with.
Well, I'm concerned that we have about three or four different views on the committee, so I'm not sure. Everything looked fine yesterday when it looked like there was agreement. I thought if I had known at the time we put this on the agenda for today that the agreement had fallen apart, I would not have done it, I think. But let me at this time ask Sue Hanna if she will come up, and we can quickly go through these. And so the committee understands where it is.
Mr. Chair, what are the three or four views?
Yeah.
You had added one that Representative Agram just added to us, added for us. One, you have the question of,
It seems to me there's two. I don't mean to be...
Well, there are now three, if you look at it from the point of view of other interests and other concerns. Amendment 6, why don't you explain what happened to Amendment 6 and then what the issue is now?
Oh, amendment...
Yes.
Can I comment?
Go ahead.
It seems to me, and let me see if I can clarify, Liz's comments the other day generated Amendment 6. Without Liz's comments, which were brought in kind of after the fact, we wouldn't be dealing with this issue at all, and it would go on, and it would be a part of the oil and gas agreement, and we would be able to move this out of the committee. If Liz, in fact, wants to make that presentation at the point when the bill moves on, then there is opportunity for her to do that.
Well, she
because of Representative Agron's concerns.
Well, I happen to agree with Liz at this point. I wasn't aware that it opened that issue, but I think it raised a major issue. It simply means that opening EF, what we would do by putting that word back in there is opening up EFU uses to even further. And I think Sue can... Let's have Sue explain where we are. We have a sense of where we agree. I've gotten a couple of notes from you, which indicates one of them's here and one's there. We're not going to be able to resolve this today. We've got people who've come up from out of town for a couple other hearings, okay. And we're just going to have to hold it over until we can see where we are. It's getting gummier and gummier. Go ahead, Sue.
I'm sorry. And how that relates to water and so on, but whatever we can do using this bill as a vehicle to protect that situation, I would be very appreciative of. So that's really all I have to say.
Are you really saying, Shirley, that it's the concept and the need you're talking about are not necessarily all the details of this particular bill?
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate that very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representatives of the City of Portland, Portland Water Department, are they here? Joe Glicker? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Joe Glicker from the Portland Water Bureau. I'm the Director of Water Quality and Environmental Policy. I hope you have copies before you of my written comments. If not, I've got some extra ones. I'd like to start out by picking up where Senator Gold just said that we don't have a problem with the goal of this bill. I think the goal of the bill is certainly supportable. However, the bill itself we do not believe is supportable. The primary water supply to the City of Portland, providing pure high-quality water, is the Bull Run Watershed. As stewards of this resource, the Portland Water Bureau views the protection of the watershed and its water quality as key to accomplishing its mission. To carry out this mission of protecting water quality, we have devoted significant resources, both monetary and human. The current year budget for the water quality program is about $2.5 million for the City of Portland. We have a staff of over 20 employees with skills in engineering, chemistry, biology, computer technology, and many other areas that work full-time to assure Portland receives the highest quality water possible. We are active in regional and national organizations devoted to improving water quality and in helping to shape national water quality protection legislation and regulations. In this session of the legislature, we are an active supporter of Senate Bill 423, the Groundwater Protection Bill, and if that bill makes it over to this side of the legislature, we would hopefully be back, have the opportunity to come back here and urge you to support that bill.
And tell us the bill again.
Senate Bill 423, it's Groundwater Protection Bill.
Okay, now let me ask you, what would that do for the Bull Run issue, since that's not groundwater?
Well, it City of Portland also has a groundwater source as a backup water supply. So you asked the question of the Health Division of, you know, professionally, what can we do to protect water quality better? That bill does that.
All right. Thank you.
Our water quality protection program is working. Portland's Bull Run supplies will be one of the few watersheds across the country that will not have to be filtered under new strict federal drinking water regulations that will come into effect this summer. Recent U.S. Environmental Protection Agency reviews of water quality from water supplies across the country led EPA itself to say that Bull Run was one of the purest raw water sources it could find. About a year ago, we completed a a search of all our archives for all old water quality data we could find, including the original water quality analysis when the Bull Run watershed was first established in the 1890s. And that comparison has shown that the water quality today, to the best of anybody's ability to tell, is as good or better than it has ever been. And despite this excellent record, we're continually striving to upgrade our water quality program. We are in the process of having a three-member independent team of outside university-based water quality experts reviewing and evaluating our current watershed monitoring program. We're in the middle of a two-year study funded by the American Water Works Association Research Foundation to evaluate the effectiveness of watershed management practices used throughout the country. We have contracted with the U.S. Geological Survey for a special study of turbidity and sediment movement and relationships to watershed management practices. We've installed experimental, state-of-the-art remote monitoring equipment in key locations in our watershed with an eye towards future improvements in monitoring for water quality. And there was a question earlier about monitoring for contaminants, and Jim Boydson from the Health Division indicated that the current regulations require 25 contaminants, and soon we'll have about 83 to monitor for. The Portland Water Bureau is already monitoring for about 150 contaminants in its water supplies. And these are just a few of the many examples of our ongoing commitment to water quality protection. And it's from this perspective that of an organization dedicated to water quality protection that we've reviewed the House Bill 2507. And again, a summary of our position is that while we support the goal of House Bill 2507, we do not believe the actual language of the bill does anything to enhance that goal. And I'm not going to go through all my specific technical comments on the problems with the bill, but I would like to hit the highlights of a couple of them. In Section 1, the public water systems are defined to include some facilities which are, quote, not under the control of the operator. Later in the bill, it makes systems liable for civil penalties stemming from violations from the bill, and these two things coupled together make a water system subject to fines for things which the bill itself expressly recognizes to be beyond their control. In Section 2, under the goals of the bill, the goal states that Goal 4 states that, quote, the cost of preserving the quality of surface water in its natural state are minimal in comparison with the cost of cleanup or treatment. And while we agree with that statement to be generally true, it ignores the fact that water supplies in their, quote, natural state still have significant sources of contamination, and that these are the primary cause of waterborne disease around the country and for which treatment is, in fact, needed. In Section 3, there's been discussion about the need for the Health Division to identify watershed boundaries. We agree that there is a need to do that, but the rulemaking process, as the bill sets up, is a very complicated and very inefficient and costly method to do that, identification. Sections 4, 5, 14, 15, and 17 remove existing statutory authorities that local entities have to control land uses and watersheds that they may own, and removes that authority and gives it to the State Health Division, and gives it with, quote, jurisdiction over all property, with no definition of what that means. And we think that there could be some significant property taking issues involved in that and significant costs to the state as a result. The Health Division already has statutory authority to issue rules on water system and watershed area operation, and indeed they have in fact done that. The Health Division rules are in OAR 333-61-050 as construction standards. 065 are on operation and maintenance, and 075 are on sanitary surveys of watersheds. Section 6 duplicates existing federal statutory language for the Safe Drinking Water Act amendments of 1986. So this bill requires the state to do things that it already is required to do under federal law, and as such serves no useful purpose. And the fact that the language is lifted directly from the federal act creates some literally meaningless provisions. For example, subsection 3 states that a municipality with primary enforcement responsibility shall adopt any necessary regulations. And in fact, municipalities do not have primary enforcement responsibility. That's a function of the state under federal law, and there's just no corresponding function under state law. Finally, on the bill itself, section 16. This section strips water rights from those who had them on the Little Sandy or Bull Run rivers prior to 1909 and gives them to the city of Portland. We do not believe that any such rights exist on the Bull Run River prior to this date. However, there are some on the Little Sandy. And while the city of Portland would, of course, appreciate such a kind gesture from the legislature, we do not believe that such an action at this time and in this manner serves the interests of either statewide water rights law or the Portland metropolitan area. This bill also provides, the section also provides, that a lawsuit may be brought by anyone who is, quote, adversely affected by an activity in the Bull Run or Little Sandy watershed. There's no standard given as to what may adversely affect means, and therefore the bill is very vague. As you can see, there are a number of technical problems in fact every section of the bill that we believe makes the bill basically unworkable, and do not believe it ought to be reported out of committee.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Agnew.
Just quickly, I want to make sure I heard what I think I heard.
Don't ask him to repeat it, Reverend.
No, I won't. I'm going to feed it back to make sure if I was correct. You have looked back at the records of water quality for some period, some decades apparently, and you have found that as a result of the activities undertaken in the Bull Run, other activities undertaken in the Bull Run, you have not detected any degradation in the water quality. Did I hear you say that?
That is correct. That is correct. What we did is we literally searched our archives for all the water quality data that was available. There is not a lot of historic water quality data available. However, we did find a study that was done by the U.S. Geological Survey in 1911 where they extensively monitored the water supply for a period of a year. We found the original analysis for the Bull Run watershed and some others in between and compared that to what we have now. And the net result was that there's no difference that the water, and in fact, in many parameters from the data we had, the water today looks on paper to be better than it was then. We think that that's an anomaly of the fact that there wasn't a lot of data back then, but that's what the data shows us. I'd like to make just kind of, there's kind of an assumption in there about things that have gone on in the last 100 years, and there was some testimony about logging in the watershed, how much has happened. There's approximately 15% of the land in the watershed has been logged. We have records that indicate logging has gone on in the Bull Run watershed at least back to the 1890s at various levels. Most of the logging occurred in the period of the 1960s and early 1970s, but there was some that, you know, we clearly have records of that go back to the 1890s.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Weehead.
Joe, what's going on in the future? What limits are there? Do you have anything in City of Portland regulations that limit how much future logging can occur and other activities that can occur?
Sure. The Bull Run watershed itself is managed under a special federal law called Public Law 95-200, Bull Run Management Act. And that law sets up, requires that most of the Bull Run watershed is on federal land owned by the U.S. Forest Service. Public Law 95-200 sets up a process whereby water quality standards have to be adopted for the watershed. Those standards have been adopted, and in fact, there is no other watershed in the country that has raw water quality standards like the Bull Run watershed. And there's no other place in the country that has raw water quality standards of any kind. The Bull Run watershed does have those standards. The law provides that any activity that causes a change from historical water quality must be stopped under the law, and it provides for the City of Portland to have a special standing in a process, in a defined arbitration process, if there's disagreement over whether any of that is happening. So we have those, you know, there's an enforcement mechanism to deal with that. I think the city's position in terms of how, you know, what kind of activities are going to happen in the Bull Run watershed is that the City of Portland will fight any logging activity that the city feels is not for the purpose and does not in fact achieve protection of water quality to promote better water quality. So any logging that may be proposed in the watershed that is not done for the purpose of protecting water quality and is not in fact protecting water quality, the City of Portland is fully prepared to use the arbitration process to stop that activity.
Thank you very much. Representative Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Lonnie Roberts, House District 21, East Multnomah County. My major reason for being here today, Mr. Chairman, members, is to support people from my area and their concerns on the Bull Run, the preservation of Bull Run, purity of water. I was happy to hear the individual from the Portland Water, I believe the Portland Water Bureau, making a statement about how pure the water is out there. I keep telling my people out there the water isn't that pure and they need a $400 million sewer system. Maybe we don't need it now. But let me say, Mr. Chairman, members, that as we all know, the federal government is coming down with far stricter rules on water purity. They're jumping a number of impurities up to over 80. The problem is, if we do not do something to assure that the standards of the Bull Run are maintained, the future cost will be astronomical. The filtration systems that they're speaking of would be far cheaper than if we find that we've made mistakes in logging in the Bull Run or some other mistake. It would be far more costly than what we are talking about here. What I see in House Bill 2507 is an attempt to just assure the people who rely so heavily on the Bull Run watershed that that quality will continue for a long period of time. And if we have to invest monies today to save the water and monies tomorrow, I think it's a very wise decision to make. And with that, that's all I have to say, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to close the hearing in 2507 for a few moments and go on to a work session on Senate Bill 39 while we still have most of our members. They'll be outside. 2507, temporarily, the hearing is temporarily closed, and I'm opening the work session on Senate Bill 39. Let me ask Mike Greeney if he would come up. Mike, if you would, we had the hearing on this on Monday. If you would go through with us the amendments that have been agreed to earlier, and I understand that Mark Nelson has some, the department does not agree with, but why don't you go over these first so we know what these are, and then we'll take a look at what the other is and see if by chance we can maybe put something out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mike Graney from the Oregon Department of Energy. Briefly, Senate Bill 39 again provides us with three things. The clarifies the ability to recover all site application costs, not only for ourselves, but also if the department needs the services of another state agency as part of the Siting Council's review. Second, it allows us to recover from regulatory costs of existing energy facilities. Currently, there's a statutory cap in ORS based on the size of the facility. And third, it allows us to recover full costs for Trojan emergency response. Again, there was a cap in statute. Now, the amendments that you have, the A-10 amendments and the engrossed version that's dated 3/15/89 picks up a number of things. First of all, the Ways and Means Committee recommended that as part of the Trojan emergency response, a new cap that covers our full costs be included in the bill, and this the amendments do that. And that fee is $922,500. By comparison, our current emergency response efforts are about $800,000 for the current biennium, but PGE was paying only $300,000 of that because of the statutory cap that previously existed. The difference was being made up by other energy suppliers. There are also amendments at Pacific and PGE's request that require substantiation and documentation of all of our fees, site certificate application fee charges, regulatory charges, as well as the Trojan emergency response charges, which we agreed to. There are also criteria regarding the standards for billing, that those costs be just and reasonable and necessary related to those specific facilities. Those utilities with large payments for energy facilities over 500 megawatts, we can provide for negotiated extended payments so that they don't have to pay us all once a year as they currently have to under current law. It also makes clear, the amendments make clear, that by paying these fees to us, a site certificate holder or applicant is not waiving rights to challenge any of the appropriateness of any of those fees. And it also clarifies that our legal fees relating to defending the decision can only be paid would be paid unless the Siting Council's decision is found not to have a basis in law or fact for its decision. In other words, was arbitrarily made. In addition, Klamath Falls expressed some concerns that this bill could be read retroactive so that other state agencies that had incurred costs reviewing that project would be able to bill the applicant. That is not the intent, and we have included an amendment that explicitly makes clear that the charges and the fee structure under this bill are prospective only. In addition, there is another amendment. But first, let me say with those amendments, it's my understanding that the bill has the support of Portland General Electric, Pacific Power, which are the ones who would be paying the principal fee increases. And no other energy suppliers or utilities have raised objections to the bill. The City of Klamath Falls has raised a couple of additional concerns, which we've tried to meet. One of those is that they are concerned that the ability of the Siting Council to request assistance from other state agencies in reviewing an application could be viewed as just an open-ended invitation for an agency that to intervene, and that they would have to pay all the costs of that intervention, whether or not it was work that the Siting Council was doing. I have offered and am willing to support the A-12 amendment that has DOE on the top of it. It's a one-page amendment that makes it clear that in a site application process, an applicant would be held responsible only for the Siting Council's expenses and only those of another state agency if that state agency were specifically requested by the council to study an issue, and only for the expenses related to that issue that it was studying for the council. If that state agency intervened and wanted to raise other issues, those would be on that state agency's nickel, not on the council's and not on the applicant through the council.
Let me ask you now. You have the amendments before you.
Yes, sir.
Why don't we take these one by one, so that everybody knows exactly what we've got? I would like to dispose of this bill one way or the other today.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
Before everybody gets away. Mm-hmm. All right, let's take them in order.
So the A-10 amendments constitute the bulk of the issues that I've just listed that Pacific and PGE and ourselves have agreed to regarding documentation, regarding ability to pay in installments, and regarding not waiving rights to challenge any of the fees, and including the non-retroactivity of the bill. The A-12 amendments.
Well, right. Let's.
Chair, do you want to move these one at a time?
Yes, I would. Is there any Everybody understand what the A-10 does, and there's agreement on A-10. There's not a problem on A-10. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, to my knowledge.
All right. Is there any problem with accepting the amendment to Senate Bill 39, numbered A-10?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Weehage.
This is the first time I've seen it.
Well, we've had it in the, this
year. Yeah, I just want some assurance that this is basically what we've seen before.
Yes.
Okay.
There is one, well, I think all of it's been in your packet except one new amendment, the small one we had this morning. There is one that is of some major disagreement, but this is not the one.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Hostiga.
As a matter of procedure, I'm trying to find in my folder the amendments labeled A-10. What I find is a hand in gross that says A-10 on it. Did we have distributed
the A-10? Let me ask Carol. Separate? Carol, do we have an A-10 that is not engrossed?
Representative,
yes,
right
C.
behind it.
Oh, it's stapled.
The back of that hand.
Oh, stapled to the back.
Okay.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
Right behind it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you. We recognize that the engrossed. I'm not sure the engrossed is very helpful.
Did she
went
all that work?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I would say my view is that hand engrossing is always very helpful, and I wish OLIS would help the committee staff work out a system by which they could just pull the bill onto their machines, use a different typeface to hand engross them, and I think we'd expedite matters here quite a bit. So
okay.
Put that down, Carol, right, and tell OLIS that at least I said that.
Sure.
Any questions or comments on 10? All right, that's fine. Go ahead, next one, Mike.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, should I do A-12, which we support, or A-11, which we do not support? What's your preference?
Which one is A-11? Oh, that's SALT. Okay, let's go on to that. We'll come back to that one.
Okay. A-12, we have drafted to try to be respond to some of the concerns that City of Klamath Falls raised. It clarifies that in a siting council's review of an application for a site certificate, other state agencies' expenses would only be covered under this bill if that state agency was requested by the council to participate to study a specific issue and only for the issue that the siting council requested. So if an agency intervened on other issues or as a matter of general policy, either in favor or against a proposal, that intervention would not be covered by this bill. They would not be able to be reimbursed for that. They'd only be reimbursed for expenses on issues that the siting council specifically requested. And the reason that that's important to us is that we do have small, limited staff, and frequently we do need the assistance of other agencies. We don't try to duplicate staff expertise that other agencies have when we review site applications.
No. Representative Parker.
No, it doesn't. Sorry.
I guess it was on this point, but I was contacted by one person that was concerned that this proposal could lead to unnecessary studies and kind of a blank check approach. So, for what that's worth.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parkinson, I think we've tried to address that with the amendments that PGE and Pacific requested as part of the A-10 that require that any expenses charged be just, reasonable, and necessary. And also, I think those are standards that will, plus the documentation we have to provide, I think will make it clear that this is not an open-ended invitation to do unreasonable studies or unreasonable reviews.
Representative Parkinson, of course, those words, a lot of times, the beauty's in the eye of the beholder, just, reasonable, and that sort of thing is, but that's all, Mr. Chairman.
Let me ask you, this department basically depends on fees. Is this particular bill, this isn't new in terms of what you do, is it?
No, Mr. Chairman. In fact, one utility asked if this would affect or involve us in hydro relicensing, and it would not. We have no involvement in hydro relicensing either on the federal or state level. The bill also would allow us to basically recover full costs of regulation and siting of energy facilities, and is really necessary because in the past we've had the luxury of some federal funds to make up the shortfall when we've run against the statutory caps. We don't really have that ability anymore, not with the revenue reductions of all 50% of our federal funds that we're likely to see this biennium.
Thank you. Number 12, Amendment 12, the committee did not have that prior to today. That was given to you today. You might, is there objection to it?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Agams.
I just want to be clear. What is there a relationship between the A11 and A12 amendments? Are they? I haven't heard the A11 yet, and I'm not sure that I understand whether one steps on the other or not. Is one an alternate for the other? Is one supplemental to the other, or are they totally separate issues?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Agrins, I think they're related, but probably calling them an alternative may not be accurate. I think the A-12 is an attempt to address some of the concerns that Klamath Falls raised. I think the A-11, and I shouldn't speak for their amendments, but would be a sufficiently different approach that it's amending not only what's covered by the A-12 amendments, but also the bill itself, the original bill we introduced.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
go ahead, Representative Agram.
If it's your intention to take action on the A-12 amendments,
Well, let us have a
would beg that we defer that until we see what the relationship of the other proposals
That's
are.
Fine. Mark, why don't you come up and tell us about 11?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Counsel, representing the City of Salt Caves and the Salt Cave, City of Klamath Falls and the Salt Caves Hydroelectric Project.
Yes, sir.
Excuse me. Some people would say that. Mr. Chairman, let me just, because I have not addressed the committee on the bill up to this point, speak first that the City of Klamath Falls intends and would support any bill that would cause them to have to pay for the process, processing and evaluation of their application before the Department of Energy and the Council. Our concern here with this bill is the open-ended nature of the language that is provided in the bill, that not speaking to the Department of Energy per se. As you know, we've been involved in a very long and arduous battle involving that particular proposed facility, and I think it's fair to say that there have been some agencies that have not been neutral bodies from their perspective and from our